Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. Host Teresa Wilkie talks with Professor Alan Rostron of UMKC School of Law and two of his students, Josie Ellerman and Sarah Dugan, about the importance of court watching in order to assure trust and confidence in public proceedings. Then host Margot Patterson talks with Kristen Tynan, Executive Director of the Fully Informed Jury Association, about how jury nullification and refusing to uphold unjust laws can be used to put a check on an overreaching government. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now to Teresa and her guest.
Good morning. I have with me this morning Alan Rostron, Associate Dean of Students at UMKC School of Law. He's the William Jacques Constitutional Law Scholar and professor on the faculty since 2003. He teaches and writes in the area of constitutional law, tort law, products liability, and conflicts of laws. Before becoming a teacher, Rostron worked in Washington, D.C. as senior staff attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and he's worked some lawsuits on that subject. He's brought along two law students, members of the student chapter of the American Constitution Society. They're interested to talk about the importance of law and courts. Their names are Josie Ellerman and Sarah Dugan. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming. We had tough driving to get here. Today the topic is the importance of court watching, and I want to ask you three, what are your thoughts on the topic?
You know, obviously the legal system is important in so many ways, and the more involvement you have of everyday people in the system as observers, it's valuable. Sort of one thing it makes me think about is how we've realized in recent years, you know, there's with respect to police officers, you have a lot of really good police officers who are working hard out there and doing good things, but sometimes they make mistakes and do unfortunate things as well. And we've realized in recent years it's helpful when people are watching what they're doing, and especially these days with cameras and all that sort of thing. And things have come to light that were really unfortunate and that are important to realize. Sort of the same thing with courts. A lot of judges are doing a good job and working hard, but to the extent that there's problems in the courts or they're treating people unfairly in some ways, it's nice if you have everyday regular people there who are there to see that sort of thing and shed a light on it. I think everybody does a better job when they know someone's watching them.
I know it works for me. Josie, what do you think?
I think beyond that, it's also really interesting to go and see the legal system at work, and you're able to kind of put faces and personalities to what's going on behind the scenes. So it's pretty interesting to watch.
And Sarah, what are your thoughts?
I think it's really valuable for our citizens to go and watch judicial hearings or jury trials. And the reason is because the goals of our judges are to maintain justice and to uphold public policy. So if we have our citizens there, they're more able to direct what that public policy is going to be. For example, in a rape trial case, when either a judge or attorney asks for a woman's underwear, our citizens can make people aware that those things are happening, and public policy can shift.
We were talking about this before the show. There was a rape trial, and the prosecutor asked the victim what kind of underwear she was wearing. Was that the facts of that case?
Correct. I believe it was the defense attorney asked for her underwear and what type it was, say that that was the reason.
Her,
yeah,
right, yeah. That's very interesting. You also reference something where you two say, well, people are interested to watch courts, and I know that is true. There are so many court shows on the TV even now, and people watch the courts all day for hours every day. It is interesting. It is real life. And then, Alan, you spoke about judges and the power of judges. And I want to speak about that. Certainly, judges have great discretion in court. And the American Constitution Society, you're the student advisor for that group, has a new initiative called Roadblock to Reform. So Roadblock to Reform is questioning the use of algorithms to determine whether a person is a risk assessment. So in short, risk assessments are a process or a tool the court uses to decide whether someone is too dangerous to release or a flight risk. That is, that they're not likely to show up for trial. And there's two types of assessments, clinical and algorithmic. But currently, judges more are using algorithmic assessments, and they seem to be having impacts on the number of people that are charged with crimes and then held in jail pending their trial, which is a problem for an individual. Wouldn't you agree? They lose their job. They have trouble with their family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly possible. You know, it's, as you said a moment ago, judges have a lot of discretion, and this is certainly one of those areas. You know, to have someone convicted and sentenced, you typically have a jury and there's a decision made. But when you're talking about pretrial detention, it's really up to the judge. And again, a lot of discretion, and you hope that it's exercised wisely. But to the extent that it's done unfairly, it really does have tremendous consequences for somebody. As you were saying, it can really disrupt somebody's life. And it is a difficult balance, because on the one hand, you say, well, someone's not, you know, we're not going to say someone's guilty until they're proven to be guilty. But on the other hand, there could be a dangerous person that we're not, that until their trial occurs, we're not just going to release them. So it's a difficult balance that has to be made. And you know, again, organizations like American Constitution Society are sort of looking at what's being done and the systems for doing it, and whether there are better ways that it could be managed by judges.
Whether the ways that we have been doing it are keeping astride of the way things are now.
Yeah.
So the bail system itself is essentially allowing a person to go free if they have enough money to pay for it. And a lot of people who wind up in trouble with the law don't have the money to post bail or to post bail. And so it's become an economic, it's rather like we're putting poor people in jail.
Well, yeah, it definitely does work that way. I mean, you hope that sort of the justice system treats people equally without regard to their income and their wealth and that sort of thing. But this is one respect in which clearly the amount of financial means that you have influences what happens. I mean, you can afford to get out of jail or not. There's other ways that happens. Obviously, if you're wealthy, you could afford a better lawyer and maybe you get a better result in the end anyway. But the bail system does very directly and unequivocally condition your freedom on whether you're able to either put up the money or to, you know, obtain a bail bond to be released.
The only thing I have confidence in, it's government. Courts are government, state, local, or federal government. And those systems are very overworked. There's not very many people doing a lot of work. They're representing the entire population. And sometimes when you're trying to run such a large system, you can become very callous or not pay individual attention to justice.
You know, and that's what I would say, is to take it back to court watching a little bit about what's valuable about that. You know, you could say, well, how would I know if I'm just, you know, an ordinary citizen and I go down to court? And how would I know if the judge is making a correct legal ruling and that sort of thing? And that's one thing that people can observe if they're in a court, is sort of the actual decisions that are being made or rulings. But a lot of it is not so technical. It's more the attitude. Judges have a lot of influence, I think, over what goes on in the courtroom, just in their demeanor and the way they treat people. Are they respectful toward someone? For example, let's say there's someone there who's a litigant in a case, they don't have a lawyer and they're trying to do it themselves, and they're not an expert. And you could have a judge who's very gracious and very, very helpful to that kind of person, or you could have somebody who's dismissive and rude to that kind of a person. And same in criminal trials, you know, beyond just what rulings the judge makes, there's a huge difference. You can favor one side or the other with your demeanor, and the jury can kind of see, you know, even if your rulings were actually perfectly neutral, if people can tell whether the judge is, you know, more sympathetic to one side or the other. And that's the kind of thing, again, if you had observers, just regular people there to see what's going on, it is a valuable thing. No, people really do behave better, I think, again, when there's somebody there to see it.
So recent research suggests that these concerns are valid, and more research can help determine how to create effective and biased risk assessments. That's a hard thing to do, and it's important for us all to be more involved with the courts. So if you were considering today turning on the TV and watching 2 hours of court, let me tell you, you can go to the courthouse and watch 2 or 4 hours of court, and it's pretty terrific. Now, I did not find any local court watching groups. There is a history of court watching in Kansas, and it can certainly come up again. And there is court watching in Nebraska, but largely we have to do this on our own. I borrowed from Appleseed, which is a national legal nonprofit organization that for over 2 decades, Appleseed has been a leader in championing the rights of society's most vulnerable populations. And Appleseed centers across North America are dedicated to advancing justice and creating opportunities to help low-income and working families build better lives. In that endeavor, Appleseed recommends the following standards for fairness in our court system. 1, trust and confidence in public proceedings. 2, safety, accessibility, and convenience. 3, effective participation. And 4, courtesy, responsiveness, and respect. Group, let's take it from the top here and discuss this trust and confidence in public proceedings. That's an important mandate, wouldn't you all agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sarah, what do you think?
I think that trust in our judicial system is fundamental to how our judicial system needs to work. In order to build trust in the judicial system, going to a court proceeding, watching how the courts function is very important, because we are offered a lot of sensationalized information. And when we go to court and when we can see it, we can make our own assessments on if we do trust the court system. If we don't, then we need to make some changes.
Appleseed makes the point that the court should ensure that its proceedings are accessible and audible to all participants, including litigants, attorneys, court personnel, and members of the public. You know, that is so important, to think that there are things going on that people can't hear. Now, I trust the courts are making sure that the defendant to the lawsuit can hear or speak the language or have an interpreter. That's a requirement. But it's very important for members of the public to go to see if they notice that there is some missed communication. I think trust and confidence in our court system is one of the things that helps us all obey the law, is because we believe it. We believe the law. So did you have any thoughts about that, Josie?
Well, I think part of the problem right now is that lots of people don't have trust, and we don't really have a reason to. If you're poor or a person of color or a woman, time and time again, we feel extremely let down by the justice system. And so it's very difficult to feel trusting that you will be safe and protected under, you know, the law. So it's hard to say how we can start. It seems like a really big task to start building that trust back, but currently it's maybe getting involved and actually watching the process and being a little more open and clear with how things go, people will start to feel more trusting.
When we talk about trust in the legal system and the judiciary in particular, I mean, I think there's obviously the court system runs all the way from the local judges, you know, that you'd have right here in your own town, all the way up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, for some people, they have interaction at those lower levels, those lower local levels with the actual judges. They're in court for things, proceedings of their own, or again, maybe as an observer, as we've been talking about. For a lot of other people, I think their interaction with the court is probably more through the news, through the media. And it's about things like, obviously, we went through this controversial nomination and confirmation process for the most recent Supreme Court vacancy. And so, and the kind of court decisions they hear about are going to be sort of at that level, the national controversial kinds of things. And right now, I'd have to say that kind of, the confidence in the judiciary at that level would, I would think, is at kind of an all-time low, just because there's a real sense. I think even, you know, I think people weren't ever totally naive, and they knew the judges. What the judges had discretion to make decisions, and there was some, their political views would influence that, and so it wasn't like law was this objective thing that just was handed down to the judges and they were just sort of translating it for us without some input of their own. But I think it's become ever more clear through the sorts of decisions the Supreme Court has made over the last couple decades that it's such a political thing, and it's all about who nominated the judges and who has the majority. And so there is this sense that there's, you know, liberal judges and there's conservative judges, and they're, all the decisions just turn on how many you have of each.
The Supreme Court has people that watch their trials, isn't that true? And there just can't be cameras in there.
Yeah, there's actually been a lot of discussion about that over the years. They do audio record their decisions, and it's not usually released live unless it's a really particularly important case. But shortly after the decision, they'll release transcripts and they'll release the audio recordings. But they haven't wanted to have, you know, video or in other words, cameras in the courtroom, and largely seems to be. And there's probably some justification for this. I think they're afraid in this day and age, with the way the media is, that there might be snippets that would be cut out that would make them look foolish or make them look bad. And I'm sure they see their comedy programs, The Daily Show, and these kind of things that are very well done, but that could use snippets of Supreme Court video from their arguments to make them be portrayed in ways that they don't want to be portrayed. So.
That's so true. They have a certain decorum with the judge. And since we stay on the subject of judges, I want to talk about examples of judicial indiscretion. And so one example would be jury tampering or giving an inappropriate jury instruction to the jury. In the next part of the hour, we'll have a member of the Fully Informed Jurors Association, and that'll be a great guest. But no one is really schooled on how to be a jurist. And so we believe the judge, if you're on the jury and the judge says, okay, well, this is what you have to think, that may be appropriate or it may not be appropriate. There are examples of inappropriate evidence, which objections a judge supports, which objections they don't. Can you speak on jury instructions?
Sure. Judges, you know, they, again, I think most of them work very hard and try to do a good job, but they make mistakes like anybody else. When you talk about jury instructions, it essentially means at the end of a trial, the judges actually have to literally instruct the jury. They read to them a long set of instructions that cover all of the law that's relevant for the jury to apply. The jury is supposed to be the ones that determine the facts of the case, what happened, and they apply the law to it. But the judge is the person who's supposed to tell them what the law is, and here's the elements of that crime, or here's what it means to have a contract, or whatever the case is about. And for a lot of basic issues, there are standard instructions. Missouri has a set of approved standard instructions, or Kansas would have a set of approved jury instructions. But for other issues, judges have to, when it's a sort of a more novel issue or a unique issue that's not covered by the standard instructions, judges have to come up with something. And they have to make rulings throughout the whole trial. I mean, they have to make decisions all the way about what evidence to admit, for example, what questions of what witnesses to allow, and then what questioning of the witnesses. And then even more specifically, there's sort of just the nuance things about, again, to what extent does the judge interject questions of his or her own. Again, you can do a lot that's not even really taking a solid legal position, just again with the sort of the tone and the demeanor and the way. I've been in court. I was a clerk in a court for a year, and I've been in court for other things. And you can tell sometimes the judge really doesn't like one of the lawyers, really clearly does not like one of them, or likes one of the others. And judges, again, they're people. They don't come out of some judicial monastery where they're sort of isolated from contact with things. They're almost always former lawyers. And so usually they have a bias to some extent that either they were a prosecutor or they were a criminal defense lawyer or they were a plaintiff's lawyer or they were a defendant's lawyer for corporations or that sort of thing. So they almost always have some thoughts or just inclinations like any person would have.
If people would like to be interested to watch courts, I was able to simply Google court watching and I downloaded a watch court monitoring form. So this was at Watch Volunteer at watchmn.org. This is a four-page report that gives courtroom information, information about the defendant, the victim, judicial feedback, the actions of the attorneys. And this would be very good to go and watch proceedings. It might help instill trust if you happen to know the defendant to the case and they know that someone is there watching to make sure everything's done appropriate. That just would be terrific. So, of course, there are rights to appeal, except at the Supreme Court level, although Congress can overthrow Supreme Court opinions, and so we can always have good government in the United States.
Yeah.
We haven't always had good government in the United States.
Yeah, again, I said in the past, I do feel like always the Supreme Court had a lot of respect. The attitude, I think, of people was, I may not always agree with their decisions, but I'll accept it. And even very controversial, no, obviously there's some decisions that were very controversial and there was tremendous resistance to them. But, for example, Bush versus Gore, I always give as an example of a decision where a large portion of the country strongly disagreed with the outcome, but they accepted it. It wasn't as though Al Gore tried to force his way into office or there weren't riots in the streets or that sort of thing, which there might have been in other countries, but we had a judicial system that people had that much faith in that they could accept it as resolving an important election like that. But it just, again, I think the Supreme Court knows they have to be very careful from this point on. The way things have gone, I think people are thinking of them as more and more of a political body that's not that different from other political actors, other politicians. I don't know. I've been doing this a long time, 25 years I've been involved with law. Josie and Sarah are newer to it. I don't know. Are you optimistic for the future of the legal system? Do you feel like people have respect for you? Decided to become a lawyer, I guess, so you must have a little faith in it. But
I have faith in our justice system. My faith is shaken sometimes by what's happened with our Supreme Court and things like that. But I think the important thing is for anybody who wants to have faith, anybody who wants to participate is to get involved. And that's why ultimately I'm getting involved, because I want to be the faith in the justice system.
And I have faith in a lot of my colleagues who I interact with every day, who seem extremely dedicated to really getting into the system and changing things for the better. So I have faith in the system through my colleagues.
I thank you all very, very much for coming on Jaws of Justice today, and perhaps you would be interested to come back. We have a lot of topics on the questions of court and justice in the court, and your ACS, American Constitution Society, has many good things to say about it. So thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now the calendar for the week of November 26th. Corey's Network invites survivors of murder to their weekly workshops to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. You should bring something to take notes with, and please include only those individuals mature enough in age to deal with the issues. The next workshop, What to Expect in the Investigation, will be held Monday, November 26th, and again December 3rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, KCMO. The church is located east of the Hy-Vee at 40 Highway and Nolan Road. For more information and listing of future workshops, call 816-834-9161 or email coreysnetwork@gmail.com. The Black Archives of Mid-America, the Missouri Conference of the NAACP, Missouri Faith Voices, and Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, in partnership with the Equal Justice Initiative, will erect its first historical marker to acknowledge the racial terror lynching of Mr. Levi Harrington, who was killed in the West Bottoms of KCMO on April 3, 1882. Levi Harrington was one of at least 60 African-American victims of racial terror lynching killed in Missouri between 1877 and 1950. You are invited to the dedication ceremony of the historical marker on Saturday, December 1st at 3 p.m. in West Terrace Park, 750 Pennsylvania Avenue, KCMO, to remember Mr. Harrington and to acknowledge and tell stories that are inclusive of our past in order to facilitate healing. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is Margot Patterson.
On the air with us today from Montana is Kirsten Tynan, Executive Director of the Fully Informed Jury Association, a nonprofit that tries to educate people about what their rights are as jurors. Kirsten Tynan is here to talk to us about what jurors should know and more often than not don't, because neither judges nor lawyers communicate this to them. Kirsten Tynan, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Margot. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. I want to ask you about jury nullification, a term that I was not familiar with up until a few days ago, but which is an essential, important, and little-known right jurors have. Tell us, if you would, what jury nullification is and why your association tries to spread the word about it.
Indeed. It is a third option that jurors have for delivering a verdict that they are often not informed about or misinformed about once they get inside a courthouse. Normally, we are told in jury instructions that if we do not believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the law has been broken, we must acquit. And in previous years, we would be told that if we did believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the law was broken, we should convict. That language was supposed to clue us in subtly to our third option, which is that if we believe that to convict someone who actually technically has broken the law would be unjust for some reason, we do have that third option of voting not guilty, even though we believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the law has been broken. And jurors may have a variety of reasons for doing this. They may believe in some cases that the law itself is inherently unjust, or that a generally good law is being unjustly applied in the case at hand before them. They may believe that the law is generally a good one, but that the punishment for violating it is unduly harsh, and to punish someone to that degree for that severity of offense would be unjust. Or they may believe that the law is generally good, but there are some unusual circumstances in the case at hand that would make enforcing that law unjust in that particular case. And for any of those reasons, they are perfectly free to vote not guilty.
Well, I understand that neither lawyers nor judges can tell jurors that they have this right to acquit under these circumstances you've described. Now, that incongruity seems remarkable. Why does it exist?
So it's not exactly that they can't tell them, but it is that judges and prosecutors generally have no incentive to tell them, and they do have a strong incentive to inform them otherwise. Basically, judges and prosecutors are the government trying to enforce the law. So they obviously have no reason to tell jurors that they don't have to enforce the law if they believe it would be unjust. In some places, there actually have been cases where judges or attorneys have been able to inform jurors. One such instance took place in Kansas in recent years, where a young man who had merely introduced a former high school acquaintance who had showed up back into his life to someone so that the acquaintance could make a marijuana purchase, he ended up being charged with felony murder because that acquaintance, who he did not know very well anymore, ended up, instead of purchasing the marijuana, trying to take it and killing someone. This young man had no idea that was going to take place. He had no involvement in it. But because of the felony murder rule, which is alive and well in many states, he was able to be charged with the exact same offense and be put at the exact same risk for penalty as the person who committed that crime. Well, in his case, The prosecution did something mysterious. They first filed a motion to prevent any mention of jury nullification in front of the jury, and then for reasons unbeknownst to anyone rational, I don't think, the prosecution actually brought that subject up in front of the jury. And because the prosecution opened that door, the judge allowed the defense to discuss it with the jury as well. And in that case, the jury ended up convicting him on a minor marijuana charge. But after learning about jury nullification, they refused to enforce the felony murder law against him, I presume because they thought that was unduly harsh, since he had no knowledge of or participation in that.
Well,
so
that's...
it is rare, but it does occasionally happen that jurors can be told about this.
Well, that's a fascinating case that you just described. How common is jury nullification?
Hard to say. The reason why is that jurors don't generally have to explain, they don't have to explain the reason for their vote, and they generally don't. The few times that we see it is usually because there is a high-profile case that's covered in the media, and jurors decide to speak to the press. But so few jury trials are actually covered by the media that we kind of try to collect data where we can, but we just don't have a good feel for what percentage of cases it's used in. Qualitatively, I would not describe it as rare, but also not common. I would just call it uncommon for now. That's my sense. But we do know that it's more common in certain types of cases, the most common type being what we call victimless offenses, where something has been criminalized just because it offends someone's sensibilities, not because it actually harms someone or their property. Very, very common in, well, I won't say very common overall in marijuana cases, but it, of all the trials we see jury nullification, probably the most common ones are like marijuana, recreational use, or medical marijuana cases. And I actually saw in the last, I think within the last 12 months, maybe slightly more than that, we actually have a state contact, Catherine Bernard, who is a defense attorney in Georgia, and she has successfully argued two marijuana-related cases to a jury nullification, not guilty verdict, simply by putting her client on the stand and having them tell the jury, yes, I did this, here's why I did this. No, I didn't harm anyone, and the jury went out and deliberated and came back and said not guilty, even though the person specifically stated they did it.
Well, I understand there's a long history of jury nullification, and I want to ask you about that. But first, I'd like to know, why don't defense attorneys inform jurors of jury nullification and their right to acquit?
The courtroom is basically controlled by the judge. And if the judge is unfriendly to jury nullification, they can not only squash any direct mention of it, but also prevent or punish any indirect mention of it. We have actually seen at least one case in which a mistrial was declared after the defense attorney's opening statement, not because of any mention of jury nullification, but because in the opening statement, the defense attorney mentioned that the defendant was accused of a felony. And the judge decided that because the word felony was used, that clued the jury in that the punishment would almost certainly involve prison time. And that might make them think twice about convicting because they might be squeamish about imposing prison time for the offense that was accused. So judges, who I might mention, often are former prosecutors. A large percentage of them are former prosecutors. They really control a courtroom, which means they really control how the defense attorney behaves, because if that defense attorney does not follow instructions, they can be held in contempt of court, and their livelihood could be at risk. So there's only so much that they can do. I am excited to see a few defense attorneys around the country who are a bit more aggressive on this, but for the most part, they their behavior in the courtroom is dictated by the judge.
Well, you mentioned when we spoke last week that over the years, instructions to juries have become more and more stringent and really in some cases bullying. What accounts for that?
I think that through history, at times when juries have been more friendly to certain issues and been more sympathetic to defendants on certain issues, in order to combat juries using their tool of jury nullification, courts have responded by trying to beef up certain measures, including bullying anti-jury nullification measures, or bullying anti-jury nullification instructions. In the Fugitive Slave Act era, we saw the evolution of jury instructions there, where it went from defense attorneys being openly allowed to talk about jury nullification to the jury, to judges cracking down on that. And then again in the Prohibition era, prohibition of alcohol, that was an era in which we saw a statistically significant bump in plea bargains, where prosecutors made a deal with a defendant so that they didn't have to go in front of these juries who were very sympathetic to their neighbors and didn't want to convict them for without a good cause. So that just routed them out of the jury system altogether there. And then again, we have seen in recent years, in a lot of marijuana-related cases, these same sorts of bullying instructions coming out in order to kind of intimidate jurors into thinking that, hey, I don't like this law, but there's nothing I can do. And they think they're worded in such a way that it suggests that they could get in trouble if they don't deliver the verdict that has been strongly suggested to them that the judge wants. And that is absolutely out of line. So that's why an organization like the Fully Informed Jury Association exists. We want to tell them and empower them with their rights before they get into the courthouse where they're misinformed.
Well, I understand that jury trials are becoming increasingly infrequent, that something like 95% of all cases are plea bargained. Is mm-hmm. that decline in jury trials something your association is concerned about? And do you think other Americans should also care about this?
I definitely am concerned about that here at FIJA. We hope that other people are, and I think we're starting to really see that. There was maybe a couple years ago an article in the New York Times written by a federal judge himself who said that we have gotten to the point where it is so hard to take the risk of a jury trial, for reasons I'll explain in a second, that we actually see innocent people pleading guilty just because they can't risk a jury trial. And why can't they risk a jury trial? Well, there's a phenomenon that has been dubbed the trial tax. Basically, what the trial tax means is that when you are offered a plea bargain, you are offered a certain level of punishment, usually a certain amount of prison time, a certain fine, a certain amount of probation. But if you turn down that plea bargain and take it to a trial by jury, and then are in the unfortunate position of losing your jury trial, you are almost always punished significantly more than you would have been had you accepted the plea bargain. And all of that additional punishment, that is not for your offense. We hope that people understand that is the price that you are being taxed simply for exercising your right to trial by jury. The prosecutor, when they offer a plea bargain, they're telling you what they really think is fair. When they take you to, when you take them to jury trial and make them work for that conviction, now everything above that is just to punish you for exercising your right.
This is Margot Patterson with the Jaws of Justice, and if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking to Kirsten Tynan, Executive Director of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Well, Kirsten, that trial tax, which does sound patently unfair and unjust, how are people trying to change that situation, to get rid of that tax, and how do people go about doing that?
Well, we have not seen a whole lot of movement on that particular issue. This year, the major issue that we've seen really good positive progress on for juries has been in Louisiana, where they went to, I think it's until the end of this year, they still have non-unanimous convictions in criminal jury trials. They have returned to unanimity starting next year, so that was good. With that kind of out of the way, and most likely being dealt with in the only other state that allows non-unanimous jury convictions, probably coming up this year, I hope that this will become the trial tax will become kind of a higher priority issue. It's not quite as obvious what the solution should be for that. It is quite obvious that there needs to be one, but I don't know that there is quite yet a major consensus on how to deal with that.
The website of the Fully Informed Jury Association mentions that at all levels in the United States government, government has chipped away at some of our constitutional rights. What are some examples of government overreach that you see? What are some of the rights that you see being eroded that you worry about most?
Mm-hmm. Well, for us, our main concern is jury rights. So how other people apply it really depends on what their concerns are. But in terms of jury rights, you previously mentioned the heinously high percentage of criminal trials that are adjudicated without any citizen input. And it is definitely over 95% of cases that are settled by plea bargain. There's the issue of the trial tax. There is still the issue of jury non-unanimity on the table. Even though we only currently have two states that allow non-unanimous convictions, and it looks like those states are moving away from it, unfortunately, in the 1970s, the Supreme Court ruled that non-unanimous jury convictions in criminal cases were legal. So that meant that even if it is removed in Louisiana and Oregon, other states still have the option of going from unanimity to non-unanimity. And we see a lot of situations in which the government tries to make the case that we need to sacrifice people's protections and due process in order to hurry trials along, save money, that sort of thing. There's also the issue that we're seeing a lot of people who are just figuring out that you do not even have a constitutionally, I will say, a Supreme Court guaranteed right to a jury trial if you don't meet, if the charges against you don't meet a certain level. So if you are charged with something that puts you at risk for less than 6 months in jail or less than a certain amount of fines or probation, the Supreme Court says you are not entitled to a jury trial. And let's face it, that's not a minimal sentence. That's, you know, if you had to skip your job for 5 months, not be able to take care of your kids for 5 months, how would you be able to keep your family together? How would you be able to continue to keep your car, keep your property? You would probably come out not having a roof over your head. You probably wouldn't have a job. That's a major thing. But that has been kind of the line drawn by the Supreme Court that says, this isn't major enough to warrant a jury trial. Whereas I think, if something's not major enough to entitle you to a jury trial, why is it major enough that we're arresting you for it, that we're imprisoning you for it? That's really a very serious penalty, even though it's kind of been described as not serious. That irks me to no end.
Well, I agree with you. Certainly having to go to jail for 4 months would be both unpleasant and very disturbing to your lifestyle.
And, yeah, it would be devastating to many, many people.
Was that a recent Supreme Court decision, or has that been on the books for quite a while?
I think that's been around for some time. I don't know the exact date off the top of my head on that one, but I think that has been around for quite a while.
You mentioned that you sometimes hear from jurors after a trial. Why do they contact you? Is there anything you can do for them?
Very little we can do after a trial. The reason we often hear from jurors after a trial is either they simply didn't know they had the option to acquit someone by jury nullification, or they felt like they were bullied out of it. And once they got out, they went and did their own research, which you're generally not allowed to do while you're serving on a jury, and realized that they had been misled. Sometimes we've heard from jurors who thought, well, this person broke the law. I'm just going to convict them because my fellow juror said, oh, they're only going to get community service or whatnot. And then they find out that the penalty, which they're not told about in court, and in fact are often told they're not allowed to know about in court, it's much greater than they expected. It's much more harsh for various reasons. Maybe the law in that case is particularly harsh because there was a high-profile situation that led legislators to amp it up. It may be that this was a three-strike situation where even a minor offense as a third strike kicks in an unconscionable, harsh punishment, that sort of thing. So there's very little we can do after the fact. Once someone is convicted, they no longer enjoy the presumption of innocence. There are only limited reasons which they can use to appeal their case. And this is really not one that would be accepted by court. So our goal is to make sure people are informed before they get into that situation and are empowered with the knowledge they need before they make those decisions.
And how do you go about getting the word out that jurors do have this right to acquit if they think if they think the law is unjust or is being unjustly applied?
Well, we have a number of volunteers who do great work handing out our literature outside of courthouses, at community events, that sort of thing. We also have a website at fija.org, fija.org, and we have a really large audience on Facebook. We're on facebook.com/fijanational. We also can send speakers either in person sometimes, depending on who's available and the situation, or we can do a remote talk if someone is set up for that, with the technology for that, and that sort of thing. We also have, in the last several months, been working on an amicus program where we file friend of the court briefs in key cases to help educate the court on these key issues. So we have a number of things going on. I'm, as we speak, updating the FIJA website. So my hope is to be very clear on there very soon about all the ways people can get involved.
Well, I understand that some prosecutors and officials in law enforcement are strongly opposed to juries nullifying undesirable laws. What's their argument against it?
Usually they will bring up a scare tactic. This will create anarchy. People will disregard the law for no reason, left and right. But if you think about it, that's really silly. If you look at the process, police have discretion in who they arrest, what they overlook or give a warning for. How many of us have gotten a warning instead of a traffic ticket, for example? Prosecutors have an immense amount of discretion in dropping charges against someone in order to make a plea deal. Judges even have discretion in some cases. When someone has been convicted, they can overturn that in certain situations. And even if someone has been convicted, governors and presidents generally have a power to commute their sentence or pardon them. In other words, let them go free or reduce their sentence, even though the law specified something else. And none of those things so far have led to anarchy. So why is it that we the people would suddenly make a complete mess of the system if we exercise our pardon power, jury nullification? And in reality, even when people have this power, as in the case that I mentioned before about the felony murder jury nullification, they didn't acquit that individual of everything. They still convicted him of a minor offense. If this was truly something where people would go completely out of their minds, we would never see any convictions in jury nullification cases. But we often see jury nullification cases in which major charges are nullified and lesser charges involve convictions. we're not, you know, the majority of people do not want to live in a society where murder is rampant and rape and assault are rampant. But we do want to live in a society where we're not hurting people who have not hurt us, who have not threatened us in any way, just because they offended someone's sensibilities.
Well, Kirsten Tynan, I want to thank you so much. I'd love to ask you a few more questions, but our time is up. So Kirsten Tynan of the Fully Informed Jury Association, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
And next up is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is taken from the Drug Truth Network program, Century of Lies, featuring Doug McVeigh.
On November 19th, the International Peace Institute, together with the International Drug Policy Consortium and the Social Science Research Council, co-hosted a policy forum event entitled Beyond 2019, The Future of Drug Policies and the Lessons Learned. They were there to discuss the Commission on Narcotic Drugs and its upcoming 62nd session, which will be held in March of 2019. At that time, they'll be reviewing progress toward goals of eliminating or reducing cultivation, production, trafficking, and use of illegal controlled substances. Back in 2009, the UN adopted something called the Political Declaration and Plan of Action towards an integrated and balanced strategy to counter the world drug problem. That political declaration set 2019 as the target date for the elimination or significant reduction of all this illegal drug activity. Now, anyone who's paying attention knows that they've failed. We not only have more production of cocaine, more production of heroin, more production of a lot of other drugs now than we did back in 2009. We also have new psychoactive substances that are becoming available and more widely trafficked, and some of them are extremely dangerous. Problem is worse in nations which cling to outdated prohibitionist models. Today, we're going to hear some of the voices from that Beyond 2019. First up, Craig Mochaber. He's the director of the New York office with the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Next, we turn to Mr. Craig Mochaber, director of the New York office for the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Craig, linking drug policies with human rights has been a complex task, to say the least. What are your views for the next decade of action on the world drug problem?
Thank you very much, Chair. To say the least, indeed, it has been a complex task, and I think one in which we have failed miserably to make those necessary linkages. There's a time with a lot of diplomats in the room, and we say hello to you all, excellencies, but I'm going to, with that, dispense with the diplomatic nuance that usually accompanies conversations here around the United Nations in New York to say that the so-called war on drugs and all of its cousins, various approaches based upon prohibition, have been an unmitigated catastrophe for human rights all around the planet. This has been called one of those situations where the cure is far more deadly than the disease, and I think that's been proven to be true. Literally, as we're speaking, people are being cut down in the streets simply for suspicion of being involved with drugs. People are being abducted and disappeared and tortured and abused in mandatory treatment facilities around the world.
We'll have part two on tomorrow's report. I'm Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.